New Year's Day is a little bit comical if you think about it. I think we're all more than aware of this aspect of it. There's a U2 song called New Year's Day where one of the lines is, "Nothing changes on New Year's Day." Nothing changes on New Year's Day. And the way we celebrate New Year's is interesting because we kind of manufacture a celebration. Nothing changes on New Year's Day, so we stick a ball on a pole and watch it fall. That doesn't happen because it's the new year, it happens because we put a ball on a pole to watch it fall. Nothing really changes on New Year's Day, and that's kind of a sad way to look at New Year's Day. We all want a better 2021 every new year. We want a better new year than the year before. But nothing changes on New Year's Day. Everything that was with us on December 31st, 2020 is with us on January 1st, 2021. Nothing changes on New Year's Day. And I think that what we can do is sort of harness that realization about the holiday of New Year, New Year's Day, as a backdrop, as a foil to what we've just read in these last final chapters of the Bible, in which all things are made new. Verse 5, "And he who sits on the throne and said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.'" And we don't use that word, behold. I doubt that you walked into the office recently and said, "Behold," when you wanted to get everybody's attention. But behold is a wonderful word that really means, would you look at that? I am making all things new. Completely unparalleled. Nothing changes on New Year's Day. Contrast that with the end that we're reading about here. Look at this, all things new. Now, we use the expression a whole new world. I think it's a Disney song about a whole new world after entering into some kind of a romantic relationship, and certainly that can be the feeling when you're in love, but whether it's a new job, a new relationship, a new friendship, a new opportunity, a new career, whatever it might be, we really don't know what it is to have all things new. And that is what is put on display for us here in these chapters. And there is an admonition here for us to respond, and that's going to actually organize how we look at these words before us, these passages that we've read. In chapter 22, verse 7, we read, "Blessed is the one who heeds the words," or who keeps the words, "of the prophecy of this book." And that's an interesting statement, if you think about it. You know, heed these words. Be the blessed one. It's a beatitude of sorts, one of the last ones in the Bible. So the blessed one keeps the words of this book, heeds the words of this book. And that's really an interesting ask, if you think about it, because it's not the Ten Commandments. It's not like you read after the Ten Commandments, heed these words, keep these words, do what is instructed here. It's a book of apocalyptic vision, prophecy, figurative language at very many points. And the request here is, you know, keep these words, heed these words, respond to these words, do what is asked of you by this book. And it's kind of perplexing. It's like, well, how do I do that? Apocalyptic vision and all of that. How do I keep these words? And I think it's actually opened up for us in the verses that immediately follow verse 7 of chapter 22. John, I, John, am the one who heard and saw these things. And when I heard and saw, I fell down to worship. Now he gets it wrong, and we'll come back to that in a moment or later in the sermon, that he tries to worship an angel. But after the angel corrects him, he ends with an admonition. Worship God. That's the response. So I think this is how we heed the word of the book of Revelation or keep the word of the book of Revelation. We have to hear, we have to see, and then we need to worship. Of course, we're worshiping the whole time, but the ultimate response is worship. You can't hear and see these things in faith without worshiping. So hear, see, and worship. And it's fascinating that Revelation opens with a verse that says, "Blessed is the one who reads and those who hear the words of the prophecy and keep the things," or heed the things, "which are written in it, for the time is near." So it opens with that verse in chapter 1, verse 3, and then as it comes to a conclusion in chapter 22, it comes back to that same idea and says, the blessed one, the one who is upright before God, the one who is in good standing with God, is the one who keeps the words of this vision, of this prophecy, the one who hears these words or reads these words. You can't hear it without reading it or without having it read to you, and it's appropriate to think about that with so much of history involving people who are illiterate. Their access to what is written in the book of Revelation and the blessing that is promised would not just be through reading, but from hearing it, even from a pulpit like this one, hearing the words of the apocalypse, the 22 chapters of Revelation culminating in these final two chapters from which we have read. And, you know, think even about that, what this would be like to hear the book of Revelation simply read from your place of worship all the way back in those first days of the church. And think about this passage we have read. Something kind of interesting struck me as I was meditating on it. I came to it just simply because it's about all things new instead of being about a New Year's Day in which everything is actually the same as the day before. You might be different. You can certainly tell me. I don't think these are super popular passages from the Bible. I mean, if you think about something like the Lord's Prayer, which is on our lips every day, or the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, Psalm 23, like a psalm that even unbelievers are familiar with and often have memorized, or in our kind of reform circles, something like Romans 8 or Isaiah 53 or Philippians 2 on the incarnation, or the birth narratives because we come upon Christmas every year, the resurrection accounts because we come to Easter every year, Genesis 1 in the beginning because at this time of year, we all think that we should read through our Bible this year, and we begin at the beginning, in the beginning, with Genesis 1. Well, what about these last two chapters, Genesis 21 and 22? It's actually strange that these are not really familiar to us, like intimately familiar to us, not kind of like, oh, those strange, esoteric, enigmatic ending to a book full of prophecy, but like, this is the end. This is what it all comes down to. These are promises of a magnificent caliber. And, you know, before anything else, I think maybe we should entertain the idea of having as a resolution just to come back to this over and over again and become very familiar with these words. And if not memorizing them, at least conversant with them, chewing on the ideas and the images that are set forward, and really meditating on the promises that are extended. An appropriate resolution for 2021 to put these glorious chapters into the sort of pantheon of chapters and sections of Scripture that we enjoy so much. And I think that is so appropriate for an idea that is tossed at us throughout all of the book of Revelation, which is that Jesus Christ is the Alpha and the Omega. So Revelation 1:8 says this, Revelation 1:17 through 18 says this. We read it in chapter 21, verse 6. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And then it occurs again in chapter 22, verse 13. Alpha, Omega, first and the last, beginning and the end. And he's saying, yeah, I am the end. You know, I was there in the beginning, as John chapter 1, verses 2 through 3 says, that he was in the beginning with God, all things came into being through him, and apart from him, not even one thing came into being that has come into being. He's the beginning. Jesus is in the beginning, but he's the end as well. He's not just the Alpha, he's the Omega. He's not just the first, he's the last. He's not just the beginning, he's the end. And he's saying, here's the ending. I'm coming back into mid-story where all of you are with all of your trials, difficulties, and I'm saying, here's the end. I'm trustworthy. I am the beginning. I am the end. And it even goes further than that. In that first chapter of Revelation, it's not just I'm the Alpha, the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. I was dead, but now I'm alive forever. It's not just that I was there in the beginning and that I am the end and I'm reporting to you from the end about the end. I experienced it. This life that you're going through is one I went through. I died, and now I'm alive forever. And I'm telling you in these final chapters, this is the end. This is where it's going. Coming to us mid-story, as I say. And it is a privilege of us who live in this new covenant age, New Testament age, a new age, to have this revelation. And something I think we should be more conversant with, meditating upon, chewing on, loving the imagery, thinking about how it responds. And it's not just the imagery. Part of why I read the excerpts I did is because it really is straightforward. It's not hard to understand. It's not strange to kind of wrap your mind around. I think maybe if we got into the dimensions of the new heavens and the new earth, it would lose us a little bit, and maybe it was written for an age that was more used to a physical Jerusalem and a physical temple. But what we've read here, it's just glorious and beautiful. Something that even children can stop and think about and meditate on. And the promises are certainly not cloaked in figurative language. They're some of the greatest promises in the entire Bible. I don't think you come across the caliber of these promises anywhere else. I mean, chapter 21, verses 3 through 4. And I heard, see that here? And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. Don't you love that it's just the first things? You know, think about any list. You never make a list of one thing. The very idea of a list means that it's going to be longer than one. Everything at this point, the end of human history as we know, it's just the first things. Because there's an eternity to come that will be so new and radically different from all that we've known. But look at these promises here. And, you know, I have them too. There are difficulties, griefs, sadnesses, anguish that seem absolutely irreversible. You know, the death of someone who seems to have died outside of the faith, it just, how is that going to be undone? How are my tears from that ever going to be wiped away? And I love it. It doesn't really get into, you know, every last objection, but it makes these promises. These promises are for you. And it's not even an angel from heaven that comes to do these things, or some minister of the Lord, or a prophet, or a priest, or a human king. It's God himself who wipes away your every tear. That's a promise. And and ushers you into a world, you know, we kind of get very shorthand about the faith, like, oh, there'll be no more curse in heaven, right? No more death in heaven. Won't it be wonderful? No more mourning. No more grief. No more anguish. No more anxiety. No more tears. I think maybe children are more sensitive to this sort of thing, but sometimes they'll see an animal, a puppy or a cat, and for whatever reason, it's hurt. You know, it's just one of the tremendous child theology questions that sort of gets asked, but like, what did the puppy ever do? He didn't sin. I know Adam and Eve sinned. I know I've sinned, but the puppy never sinned against anybody. Why does he get hurt? And I don't know all the answers to this, but a whole world where there is no more pain, where that's just not a part of the makeup of the environment any longer. The caliber of the promises in this text. God himself will dwell with you. He'll wipe away your every tear, ushering you into a whole new world in which there's no more mourning, no more pain, no more tears, no more death, and all these tragedies and terrors of the world as we now know it will just be the first things. That was just first. We had to get that out of the way before a life of eternity, dwelling with God, united with him in his very presence. You need to hear these things. Hear these things over and over. Read them so you hear them. Have them read out loud. Hear these things. Be conversant with the Alpha and the Omega coming back and saying, this is where it's all headed. This is the end of the first world, the first heavens, and the first earth. But we need to do more than that. We need to see, hear and see, John says, before he gets to worship. And for two of the ideas under this aspect of seeing, I'm very thankful for Sinclair Ferguson. Of course, we're working through his book, The Whole Christ, in the adult Sunday school. But he has preached 24 sermons on the book of Revelation. He preached them in 2007, and they're all on sermon audio. And as I listened to those many years ago, he used two illustrations that just drove home to me some critical aspects of the book of Revelation, and they are very helpful even for this passage that we've read here. Now, the first point that he made is that when you get to the New Testament, you think about the gospel, four gospel accounts, and then the book of Acts, and all of the epistles that follow. What you have there is really a written history of Jesus Christ and his church, with primary resources, right? I mean, that's what the New Testament primarily consists of. It is the gospel accounts, the history of Jesus Christ himself, the history of the church, what the apostles did, the Acts of the Apostles, and then these letters that are actually written to those churches. So a written history of Jesus in the early church is mostly what the New Testament consists of. And that's a book, so to speak, or is, literally. He said, Sinclair Ferguson said, but when you get to the book of Revelation, it's the major motion picture. And, it's true. If you read through the New Testament, beginning with the Gospels, what you'll come across over and over is, it is written. It is written. It is written. And they're drawing on the Old Testament when they say that. It is written. It is written. When you get to Revelation, it's, and I saw, and I saw, and I saw. It's a moving motion picture. It's, not pictures. It has all of the special effects and dramatic effects and more than anything we're used to. It's living. He's there. He's seeing into heaven. It's the major motion picture as opposed to the historical written account. And I saw, and I saw, and I saw. And every time we come across these verbs that instruct, say that John sees, we need to see. We need to look, peer into in through the window of the Word of God and really, you know, see the things that John saw and should be asking at points, you know, do I see that? Do I imagine that? Am I fixed upon it? Can I, am I feeding upon it, realizing that this is my window into heaven? I don't need to be transported to see into heaven the way John was at the Isle of Patmos, because I have it here. This is my possession. This is my treasure as a New Testament Christian. I see these things. You need to see these things. And it's in the passage we just read. I'll go through very quickly, but chapter 21, verse 1, then I saw a new heavens and a new earth. Verse 2, and I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem. Then moving down to verse 9, the angel says, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. Verse 10, and he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the holy city. Verse 22 of chapter 21, I saw no temple in it. And then there's this extended explanation of the light, the source of light in the new heavens and the new earth. You can't hear light. You see light. That's the only way you know light is there, is by seeing it. And he sees this light, this illumination from the glory of God that we'll come to in just a moment. Verse 22, then he, chapter 22, verse 1, then he showed me a river of the water of life. And what we need to do, as I've been saying, is see these things through the window that is provided to us by the Word of God. See these things. See the major motion picture. And think about this reference to the temple. Chapter 21, verse 22, I saw no temple in it. It's a very interesting verse, right? I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb are its temple. I didn't see a temple in it because I was in the temple. God and the Lamb are the temple. The whole thing is a temple. I saw this. And you get down to the fact that there's no need for a sun or a moon in verse 23. For the glory of God has illumined it. You really should kind of think about when Revelation was written, probably written after the destruction of the temple, probably AD 90, AD 95. So an ancient Christian or Jew that was converted to Jesus Christ, hearing about New Jerusalem, you know, they'd just be on the edge of their seat like, all right, holy city, I got that much. Where's the temple? That's the center of the city, right? No temple. Because God is all-encompassing. You can't be in the city without being in the temple. That whole idea of a temple, it's unnecessary at this point. It's so new. No more division between the rest of the world and the holy temple. No more division between the sacred and the secular. It's all holy. It's all among people that are before the face of God and the Lamb. No more division. You think about the temple. I mean, that's really what you're reading about, or the tabernacle before that. It's, you know, there's all the children of Israel at a distance from the temple. And what's really remarkable is that in Exodus chapter 40, when the glory of the Lord fills the temple, not even Moses can go in there. Here, the glory of the Lord illumines the new heavens and the new earth, the new Jerusalem. And look at what you read in those following verses. The glory illumines it. The lamp is the Lamb. But instead of even Moses being pushed out by the glory of the Lord, not allowed to enter the temple that has the glory of the Lord, the kings of the earth bring their glory into it. And the nations bring the, and they will bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. You have the glory of the Lord, and then you have the glory of kings being brought into it, the glory of the nations being brought into it, because there's nothing impure allowed. Only those who are written in the book of life are allowed. People are flowing into this glory-filled temple. No more division. The most pure expression that we read of in all of Scripture of us actually dwelling with God, being with him face to face, being in his immediate presence, him being so ubiquitous that he is the light by which we see, a sort of beautiful reference back to the beginning of Genesis where we read, let there be light, before we read of a sun or a moon at all. We read here, there's no need for a sun or moon. Maybe there is one, but we don't need it any longer because we see by God's immediate light the glory of God, the ubiquitous presence of God in the new heavens and the new earth. Do you see it? A new heavens and a new earth, a new Jerusalem, no more death, all of these tragedies and terrors of this life being categorized as merely the first things. Seeing by the light of the glory of God, no more division between God and us, no more separation between the secular and the sacred, living before his face, delighting before his face. Do you see it? You know, it's really interesting. For a number of reasons, I think it's appropriate to realize that Jesus saw this. Jesus saw this. He grasped this. He knew this is what was coming. There's a passage in the Gospel of Matthew that is actually very similar to a lot of what we read here. When Satan tempts Jesus, Matthew 4, verses 8 through 11, he takes him to a high mountain and shows him all the kingdoms of the world, right? The glory of the kings, the glory and honor of the nations. And he said, all these things I will give you if you fall down and worship me. Jesus had a vision that was something like this. And Jesus said to him, go away, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only. Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and began to minister to him. You know what Satan didn't show him there? It was something similar to what we've read about in Revelation 21 and 22. But listen to this verse from Revelation 21. Come here, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. Ah, Satan could show him the new, the kingdoms of the earth, all their nations in glory, and perhaps even lean on Jesus' humanity to crave his kingship over the nations that would be an upright kingship. And maybe he showed him kingdoms that were without the sin and spoil that we're used to. But it was only by rejecting Satan's offer that Christ could go to the cross to redeem the bride, the wife of the Lamb. You and me. Jesus saw what John saw in Revelation 21 and 22. He saw, yes, the kingdoms, yes, a new heavens and a new earth, yes, the glory, yes, a new Jerusalem where God is the temple and it's illuminated by the very glory of God, but not without his redeemed bride, the church. His people from all ages, the elect, all those who call upon the name of the Lord and are saved. And you think about that verse in Hebrews chapter 12. That we should look only at Jesus, the originator and perfecter of the faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. See, he saw what John sees in Revelation 21 and 22. He saw the no more pain. He saw the no more crying. He saw the no more mourning. He saw God ubiquitous at every point with his people. He saw that there was no temple because the whole thing was a temple. He saw the bride for which he died and shed his blood, united to him in perfect harmony and communion forever. He saw the division obliterated. He saw the sacred and the secular divide broken down. He saw you reigning forever alongside of him because of what he had done for you. Therefore, even though it wasn't pleasant, even though it was torture, even though it was agony of a kind that we really can't even imagine, he endured the cross, despised the shame, to secure what we see through John's vision in Revelation 21 and 22. The major motion picture. The other thing Sinclair Ferguson said was that Revelation, the book of Revelation, is a lot like impressionistic art. And you might know what that is, you might not. Monet is an impressionistic artist. But his point was that if you have a photograph, it communicates things very accurately, very literally, right? You can't get better than a photograph if you really want a picture of where everything is and exact, precise details that mirror reality. But in impressionistic art, you can communicate a little bit more in some ways than a photograph. For instance, you can communicate the temperature through impressionistic art by using warmer colors. You can communicate something of the temperature through an impressionistic piece of art, and it evokes a greater response than perhaps a photograph was. And Sinclair Ferguson's point is, at points, the book of Revelation, it does use figurative language. It's not being literal because it's creating an impression on you. It is a piece of impressionistic art that evokes a response that draws you into what it's saying. It's better than a photograph. It's better than what literal language would be. And there's a number of points where we're just not sure if it's literal or figurative, but the reason I'm calling this to mind is of what is written in verse 4 of chapter 22. It's kind of a strange verse if you think of it literally. Speaking about all of these inhabitants that are in the book of life and are now in the new heavens and the new earth. And it says, they will see his face and his name will be on their foreheads. Or literally, they will see his face and his name on their foreheads. If you think about that literally, it's just kind of odd. It's like, you know, a name tattooed across our forehead. But if you think of it impressionistically, what a beautiful picture. There's just this eternal benediction where all of the inhabitants of the New Jerusalem, the New Heavens, and the New Earth are gazing upon God, you know, into his blessed presence and reflecting his name. He calls to mind the idea that we're his treasured possession. He has his name on us. And his face is constantly beaming towards us. We see his face. His name is on our foreheads. So we have to see these things. And there's so many other things packed into these chapters. But I'll leave that to you throughout this new year, since you now have a new resolution to become conversant with these chapters. Hear what's written. Hear the promises. Also see what's given. Think of it in terms of a major motion picture. Think of it in terms of impressionistic art and feed upon the realities that are presented here. And don't stop there. Go from hearing and seeing exactly what John does throughout the book up until this point, which culminates in worship. And as we come to the theme of worship, or the call to worship, there's a thread that we've not done an awful lot with that kind of comes into real clarity and focus here in a beautiful way. All the way at the end of the Bible, you know, the very last chapter of the Bible. And this is kind of, this isn't just one of us that is writing our account. This is John. This is the beloved disciple of the Lord, writer of the Gospel of John, writer of the letters of John. He worked miracles. He was one of the first apostles. He was in some way especially beloved by Jesus. So he saw Jesus Christ up close, personal, knew him, was in his inner circle. What's more, as you read the book of Revelation, chapter 1, he has this just amazing, beyond us, heavenly encounter with Jesus Christ, not Jesus Christ incarnate, but the glorified Jesus Christ. Amazing person, this John. And he, in this final chapter of the Bible, commits idol worship, idolatry. You know, of course, I think there's a lot going on in this that enables us to kind of go lightly on him. He's just overwhelmed with this picture of the new heavens and the new earth, seeing firsthand the major motion picture of God and the end of all things, which will really be the beginning of all things. But he worships the angel, and he has to be corrected by the angel. He's not flawless at all. This hasn't made him a sinless person. He's not a saint the way the Roman Catholic Church lifts up saints for worship. He falls down to worship at the feet of an angel. He's committing angelolatry, whatever it is. And what I love about it is he's not thrown out of the vision he's having. He's not thrown out of the encounter with God. It's just the angel just corrects them. Don't do that. Like, do you realize where you are, man? You're on holy ground. Nobody has seen this before. You're like beholding the presence of God and all that it will be in the new heavens and the new earth where there is no sin, where there is no idolatry. Don't do that. Don't contaminate the area. And if nothing else, that communicates to us grace for us sinners. The Apostle John didn't even get it right at the last chapter of the Bible. After all that he saw, all that he heard, he still got it wrong. He still committed some form of idolatry. But we do as well. We are broken. We are fragmented. We are sinners to the very last. We shouldn't pretend that we're going to attain to perfection before we're taken away to glory, because not even John had that. There's grace for us sinners. And before that encounter, the way chapter 21 closes, so beautiful. Verse 27, there's nothing unclean. No one who practices abomination and lying shall ever come into it, but only, you know, if you just stop there, whoa, are we all on thin ice? What do you mean, nothing unclean? No one who practices abomination and lying. I think we've all told a lie at one point or another. None of us, we're all excluded, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. That refers back to something written earlier in the book of Revelation, chapter 20, verses 12 through 15. Now, whenever you're talking about the books, even in our day and age, especially if you have any familiarity with accounting, the books, it's a record of activity, a record of actions. And in chapter 20, verse 12, we read, "And I saw the dead and the great and the small standing before the throne, and books," the books, "were opened, and another book was opened, which is the Book of Life. And the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books." There are the books, perfectly kept books by God Himself, by which everyone is judged according to their works. But there's another book, the Book of Life. There's grace for us sinners. There is the bride. There is the bride of the Lamb. There is the ones for whom he died to save. And every one of those names written in the Lamb's Book of Life goes into the New Jerusalem. There's grace for us sinners. It's extended to you. Come, call upon Jesus. Call upon the name of the Lord. Be saved. Make him yours. Trust in him. There's no hope in those books. They're kept too well, and you've sinned too much. You need to be written in the Lamb's Book of Life. The only entrance comes through that other book, the Book of Life. Grace for us sinners. And there's also grace in what we've already looked at, that it's not just this grand new heavens and new earth, but the bride, the redeemed, those purchased by the blood of Christ, his own treasured possession. Grace for us sinners. So in that grace, hearing, seeing, considering these promises that it's not just a life of inactivity for all eternity in some ephemeral heaven, but is instead reigning forever as the priests that you are now in that eternal temple, serving, reigning forever and ever. Chapter 22, verse 5. Worship. Worship. Think about all of the difficulties of this world and realize it is a chapter that is leading up to this one. The Omega has come back into time to speak to you mid-story, to tell you how it's going to end, and that end will just be the beginning, just the first things. Worship Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, the husband of the bride, the one because of whom the Book of Life was written. Not an angel, before whom angels simply say, I'm just a servant like you. Jesus Christ, the King of Kings. Hear him, see him, worship him, and love that reality that, you know, for so many other aspects of life, you have to put the brakes on, halt, hold back. You know, don't get too involved with it. All things in moderation, but not when it comes to worshiping him. Abandon yourself in worship before him. No other gods before him. Him alone. Worship Jesus Christ, the King of Kings. And realize that that passage we read from Hebrews 12 about Jesus Christ, who saw these things and endured the cross and despised the shame, it is what Jesus did. But the reason Hebrews has that written is for your sake. The next verse in Hebrews 12 says, consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Hear, see, worship. It will sustain you through even enduring your cross. Blessed is he who heeds the words of the prophecy of this book. Father in heaven, we pray.